Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I am your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today, my guest is Brooke Winter. Dr. Winter grew up in Anchorage and then went to Stanford University for college, then on to the University of Washington for medical school. From there, she moved on to St. Louis and Washington University for training as a gynecologic surgeon. Along the way, she managed to do some research and became first author on a report on the effectiveness of long-acting reversible contraception. That was published in one of our most prestigious journals, the New England Journal of Medicine. Today, she is assistant professor in the Division of Minimally Invasive Gynecologic Surgery at Washington University School of Medicine. Today, our topics will be two. We're going to discuss contraception. I think it's reasonable to go over some newer issues and recommendations for contraception, but also we'll move on in, as time allows, to talk about her special interest, which is minimally invasive gynecologic surgery and what that can do for women. Dr. Winter, thanks for joining us on Line One.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let me also remind everyone just real quickly, if you have questions about that you'd like Dr. Winter to address today, 550-8433 is our toll, is our regular number, 550-8433. We also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Well, Dr. Winter, last time I saw you sitting next to my daughter at the Anchorage Youth Symphony. You were the principal oboist, or I'm sorry, principal flutist. My daughter was the principal oboist. So it's a real pleasure to get to talk with you again.
Yeah, it's great to be on the show.
You've been busy. Lots of very influential educational opportunities, so we really appreciate this. Before we really talk about birth control, I think it's worth mentioning that I had heard recently that Carl Gerassi, a PhD chemist who's really sometimes called the father of birth control pills, has recently died. He died at 91 in January. He was really quite an individual. Besides being a very world-class chemist, he apparently was a pretty good novelist and playwright. So I have to ask, in all your experiences there, have you run across this guy?
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. Dr. Gerassi was quite a character. He was actually a Austrian Jewish refugee who arrived in America when he was only 17 years old with his mother. And they were poor, totally broke, in fact. So he wrote to Eleanor Roosevelt asking for assistance, and she gave him a college scholarship. And he went on to put his education to really good use. He became a playwright, an author, and a professor, like you mentioned. But he is most well-known for his work as a chemist and has been dubbed the father of the birth control pill. Now, this is actually a little bit of an exaggeration. He worked in a lab that developed the first affordable oral form of progesterone, which went on to become an ingredient in birth control pills. Mm. However, at the time, he thought the drug was going to be used as a fertility treatment, not for contraception. It was actually a team of other scientists and physicians who, at the request of Margaret Sanger, who was the founder of Planned Parenthood, they developed, tested, and got FDA approval for the first birth control pill. At that time, you know, birth control pills were very controversial and kind of a revolution. You know, for the first time, sex and pregnancy were not necessarily linked, and women could reliably delay childbearing even after marriage to finish schooling or further their career. Around that time, the rates of women enrolled in college and in the workplace went up, and the pill market became very lucrative. So eventually, Dr. Gerassi's pharmaceutical company started producing pills, and he went on to lecture and widely promote the pill.
So he
was sort of the father of birth control pill a little bit later in the in his career.
Right. Yeah, oftentimes the story is not quite as dramatic as it, the short answer to this. So thanks very much for that information. It's interesting. All right. So let's. What I want to do is get to the paper you were the first author on, and the way I think I'm going to do that is help listeners understand a couple of definitions, or at least one. That's unintended pregnancy. And for most into people doing research, we have to have a particular definition of what we're talking about. So an unintended pregnancy is mistimed, unplanned, or unwanted at the time of conception. And It's felt in the United States that about one half of all pregnancies would fall under that definition of unintended. And I believe that may be what drove you and your other researchers to look into this, because it is also felt, or at that time it was felt, that that about half of the unintended pregnancies were due to contraceptive failure. Is that fair to say? And then help us understand the emphasis for doing the study you did.
Yeah. Well, so that's exactly right. About half of pregnancies are unintended. And, you know, half of those are the women just aren't using birth control. They're not planning on getting pregnant, but they're also not using birth control. And that seems like a little bit confusing, but that happens a lot. And then the other half of women are trying to use birth control, and they get pregnant anyway. And the bottom line is that most birth control methods are very effective if they're used perfectly, but the catch is that most methods are almost impossible to use perfectly. So take the birth control pill, for example, which is the most common birth control method used in the U.S. It's actually difficult to remember to take your pill every day, let alone at the same time every day, or find time to pick up your new pill pack from the pharmacy every month, or to remember to schedule your OBGYN appointment in time before your prescription runs out. So despite their best efforts, women miss pills, and then they get pregnant. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be honest with you. I'm a doctor, and I can't remember to take a pill every day.
Right, right.
The long-acting methods of birth control, on the other hand, are pretty much impossible to screw up. So those long-acting methods include the subdermal implants and intrauterine devices, or IUDs. The doctor puts them in the office, and then you don't have to do anything for 3 to 5 to 10 years, depending on which device you choose.
Okay. So what you did in your study was look at that, or look at what was happening to unintended pregnancies?
So the Contraceptive Choice Project out of Washington University was a huge project, which was ongoing when I got here as a resident physician. So in the Choice Project, we gave 10,000 women in the St. Louis area free birth control of their choice, and then we watched what happens. And there's been quite a few. There have been a lot of studies published out of this project.
Okay.
In our project, we were looking at contraceptive effectiveness and looking specifically at the pregnancies that occurred in these women in the Choice Project.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And what we found is that the women that were using the long-acting implants or the longer-acting devices like the subdermal implants or the IUDs were 20 times less likely to have an unplanned pregnancy than women who were using the shorter-acting methods like the pills. And then when we kind of dialed that down and we looked specifically at the teenagers and adolescents who were using pills or the other shorter-acting devices, these girls were twice as likely as the older women to have an unplanned pregnancy. So all of the women were bad at taking their pills, but the younger women were especially non-compliant.
And this study was done over somewhat recent period of time, you said?
Yeah, the enrollment was between 2007 and 2011 is when it closed, I believe.
Yeah.
So I had the great fortune of being a resident here at the time that they had actually just finished enrolling. And I initially went to my research mentor, Dr. Piper, and I suggested that we just look at the teen pregnancies in the study population. And his first reaction was that there wouldn't be that many pregnancies. These were women who had chosen to enroll in a birth control study and were getting free birth control, for heaven's sakes.
Right.
But he looked into it, and he realized that not only were there quite a few teen pregnancies, but that none of the other researchers on the project were specifically looking at any of the pregnancies. Everyone was kind of focused on the contraceptive methods and not so focused on the pregnancy rates. They didn't set out to study the effectiveness of birth control. That had sort of already been studied, but it had never been studied in such a large prospective way. So sort of in the middle of this whole thing, we discovered that we were sitting on this sort of a gold mine of data.
Right.
So we set out by dividing the women into the two groups, those who were using short-acting methods like pills, the contraceptive patch, or the vaginal ring, and then the other group was the women who were using the long-acting methods like the implants or the IUDs. And when we got the results back from the statistician, we were honestly surprised. We expected to find a big difference, but we didn't expect the difference to be that big. I mean, in medicine, it's very rare to find a treatment that is 20 times more effective than another treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And the remarkable thing to me is that implants and IUDs are still so underused in this country. Right. If a new drug for cancer or heart attack or stroke became available that was 20 times more effective, right, everyone would switch to the new method. It would be crazy not to. But unfortunately for birth control, this hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, and I think as we move through the program, hopefully we can perhaps get some understanding of why that may be. At the time of the study, what percentage of the girls that were given free birth control were using the long-acting versus the more traditional reversible contraception?
So in the general population at the time we wrote the paper, the rate of IUD use, I believe, was like 5 or 6% in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And in our study population, when women enrolled, they were kind of read a standardized script, which offered them all of their contraceptive options, the pros and cons, and the effectiveness of each method. And with just sort of presenting women that information, 70% of them chose a long-acting method. So what that says to me is that if providers were more thoroughly counseling patients up front, then more patients would be choosing these methods. And that's what I've found in my own personal practice as well. Mm-hmm. It's a personal decision. The woman gets to choose. You don't have to force her to have an IUD, mm-hmm, but you just lay out the information. And, most women are going to choose not to have to be compliant with a medication every day.
Mm-hmm. Were teens involved in this, or are this individuals, let's say, greater than 18 in general?
Yes, this study included teenagers and adolescents, and we've published papers, specifically looking at these young women, and the long-acting methods were found to be safe and effective and well-tolerated, even in the younger women.
Mm-hmm. So listeners may wonder, one of the barriers I think perhaps we should just get off the table to begin with is that pediatricians are going to be counseling, for the most part, abstinence. But when faced with a girl who would like to have birth control, there gets to be a problem from the get-go in confidentiality. And even though as a pediatrician I may say I want to protect that girl's confidentiality, because mm-hmm, she is of an age where she should get just as much as an adult, there is going to be a cost associated with mm-hmm, the procedures. And so it becomes a little bit difficult to really protect that confidentiality. So that's perhaps a barrier in certain age groups.
Yeah, and that's hard to deal with, because at some point, insurance companies are going to get billed, and right, it's hard to guarantee that that's not going to, mm-hmm, that information is not going to become available to their parents. Mm-hmm. I mean, basically, for girls and young women, the decision about when to become sexually active is a personal one. And I personally think most teenagers are too emotionally immature to kind of deal with the emotional and physical consequences of being sexually active. But unfortunately, abstinence-only education in this country has been totally ineffective, and we have one of the highest teen pregnancy rates of developed countries. So to parents, I would say, if you don't want your teenager to become sexually active, I would encourage you to discuss your goals and values with them early, before they're faced with making that decision, and, communicate directly what you expect. Some parents would prefer their child wait until after high school. Others feel strongly that they should wait till marriage. Need to have that conversation. And even if you do have that conversation, some teenagers are going to choose to become sexually active. And in that case, when I see teenagers in clinic, I encourage them to be open and honest with their parents, because even though this is uncomfortable in the short term, in the long run, it makes it much easier to get them the birth control and the health care that they need. And for parents, having a sexually active teenager might seem like the end of the world, but I would like to remind them that having a pregnant teenager is probably worse.
Yeah, right. And just to also be clear, as a pediatrician, we definitely have mothers and daughters who come in requesting birth control. And so that does happen as well. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about these reversible methods of birth control in a little bit more depth, if you don't mind. Each one, perhaps talking about, what patients want to know is what's the risk benefit costs come in. So as we mm-hmm, go through a couple of the more common methods, let's flesh out some of this information. Comfort level of putting some of these in, duration mm-hmm, of activity, and so forth.
So let's see here. Well, Let's start with reversible birth control methods and then go in order from most effective to least effective.
Okay.
So long-acting reversible methods, or LARCs as we like to call them in the medical community, include subdermal implants and intrauterine devices, or IUDs. Both of those devices are extremely effective, with failure rates of less than 1%, which is just as effective as a tubal ligation, but they're reversible.
Mm-hmm.
Depo Provera shots are injections where you have to come back to the clinic every 3 months for an injection. That failure rate is around 6%, but I find that women have a hard time making it back to the clinic for a shot every 3 months, and they can also cause weight gain. It's the only birth control method that can cause a significant amount of weight gain, so it doesn't happen to everyone, but for that reason, this is not my favorite type of birth control.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of going down the line, birth control pills, which require taking a pill every day, a transdermal patch, which looks kind of like a smoking cessation patch that you change once a week, and then there's a contraceptive vaginal ring that's inserted in the vagina like a tampon that a woman changes once a month. Those are all the same type of medication. They're just delivered via different routes, and their failure rates are all about 10%. Condoms alone have a failure rate of about 20%. However, it's important to note that all the other methods I just talked about protect against pregnancy but don't do anything to protect against sexually transmitted infections. So if that's a concern, condoms are required on top of whatever else you're using. Then there's spermicide. Spermicide alone is not very effective with a failure rate of almost 30%. And then there's emergency contraception, which is birth control that's taken after unprotected sex and should only be used as a last resort. There's two different kinds. There's Plan B, which are pills, and there's a copper IUD insertion. And either of these methods can be used within 5 days of unprotected sex, but the sooner the better.
Mm-hmm.
There is the rhythm method, in which a woman tries to predict which 10 days in her cycle she's fertile and avoids having intercourse or uses a barrier method on those days. Unfortunately, it's really hard to predict which those 10 days are, especially if a woman's cycle is irregular. So the rhythm method has a failure rate of about 25%.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there's permanent sterilization, which is very effective with a failure rate of less than 1%. For a woman, this is a tubal ligation or a tubal occlusion, and for men, this is vasectomy. It's important to note that the failure rate of a tubal ligation is low, but it's not zero. And if a woman gets pregnant after having her tubes tied, it's more likely to be a dangerous tubal or ectopic pregnancy. You know, I think the sticking point for a lot of women is just sort of the notion that they don't want something foreign implanted in their body.
Right.
And that's kind of hard to get past. And then, if you just sort of talk them through it and explain that we have used these devices in a lot of people and they're safe and they're well tolerated, just to kind of sort of talk you through what an insertion looks like. So the next one on, which is the implant that goes in the arm, is good for 3 years. We numb up the skin of the upper inner arm, and then we slide this little matchstick-shaped implant just underneath the surface of the skin. The numbing medication stings, but once you're numbed up, you can't really feel anything else. Some women with the implant in place have no periods, which is not dangerous, and most women actually kind of view as a nice side effect. Other women can get irregular bleeding, which is not usually heavy, but it can be kind of unpredictable. But the implant is fantastic. Birth control failure rate of less than 1%, and good for teenagers who are, may not have even become sexually active yet and are planning on being sexually active or never had a pelvic exam. And then the IUDs. Those are intrauterine devices, and they look like little plastic T-shaped devices that are inserted up inside the uterus. They are put in the office during a pelvic exam, and it feels to a woman like she's getting a pap smear, but then there's an extra cramp. I can tell you from personal experience, I'd put in a ton as a doctor before I had my own put in, and I was afraid that I was going to be a huge baby and have to go lie on the couch afterwards with a heating pad. And I'm not going to lie, it hurt going in, but it was over quickly, and afterwards I was totally fine. I went to lecture afterwards. So in my clinical practice, when I share that personal story with patients, it's very effective. So I think obviously not all doctors are female with IUDs, but, just hearing personal stories like that, as IUDs and implants become more popular, then women talk to other women who have them, and I think it's really sort of those personal experiences that sometimes convince a woman that she's going to be able to get through this and it's going to be great afterwards. There's three different brands of IUDs. There's a Skyla, which is newer. It's a three-year IUD, and it's slightly smaller, and it has almost no effect on periods. The Mirena IUD is good for 5 years, and with it in place, most women wind up with a light monthly period or no period at all, which, again, is safe and is something most women view as a nice side effect. And then the Paragard is a copper non-hormonal IUD, which is good for 10 years, but it often leads to heavier, crampier, longer periods. So of all the long-acting devices, the Mirena IUD seems to be the most predictable and have the most favorable effect on periods. So for that reason, it seems to be the most popular. However, like I mentioned earlier, for teenagers who have never had a pelvic exam or who have never been sexually active, the implant in the arm may be less intimidating and is also a really great option. Mm-hmm.
What about removal? Is there a problem with removal? How fast do periods or risk of being pregnant occur after? Let's say just talking about the IUD now, and then you can also answer that about the implant, same kind of question. Mm-hmm.
Well, in terms of the, I don't think this is what you meant, but in terms of the technical process of removing the devices, yeah, removing them is usually easier than putting them in. So removing the implants in the arm used to be difficult, and they've redesigned the implant, and that's no longer a problem. Removing the IUD is not uncomfortable, like having it put in, so that's not a problem either. In terms of return to fertility, there's quick return to fertility with both types of devices. The only birth control method that can have a little bit of a delayed return to fertility that's significant at all is the Depo-Provera shots. And as I mentioned earlier, those can also cause weight gain, so those are not my favorite.
Mm-hmm. Other side effects. You mentioned the weight gain. What about, I've heard women talk about maybe increased risk of migraines or other problems that you might have heard about or we know are a consideration for safety.
Yeah. Most birth control is pretty well tolerated with minimal side effects. Most of the side effects are in the bleeding patterns, and if you choose the right birth control method, a lot of times that's a nice side effect as opposed to an unwanted side effect. Migraines are tricky. Migraines seem to respond to estrogen, so sometimes birth control pills help and sometimes they hurt. Birth control pills taken continuously, which is skipping the placebo week and going straight to the next pack, if a woman has a menstrual trigger for her migraines, that can actually help. And I think that the IUDs and the implants would be fairly neutral for that. IUDs, anytime we're doing a procedure where we're inserting a device into the uterus, there's always a theoretical risk of bleeding, infection, pain. If IUDs are inserted too deeply, they can wind up in the woman's abdomen, which can require a outpatient surgery called laparoscopy, where we go in the belly button with a camera and we have one small port off to each side and we remove the IUD. Knock on wood, I've never actually done that before, but it's a small risk that women should know about. But it is extremely, extremely uncommon.
Mm-hmm. So listening to you and just thinking about this, the implants may be a better choice for a woman who is not sexually active, has not been sexually active, and maybe others. But in general, the IUDs perhaps offer a better long-term option at least from your point of view, it sounds like.
I think it's a conversation you have to have with the woman or the teenager or adolescent. The real risk with Nexplanon is that some people do get irregular bleeding. And, mm-hmm. For some women that doesn't bother them. They just carry a tampon with them and they're just happy they have great birth control. For other people, it's very bothersome, and that's the most common reason people want that removed. Mm-hmm. So I have definitely put in IUDs in adolescents or teenagers who have sort of recently become sexually active, and it's just a conversation you have to have with them. Some of them tolerate it. A lot of them tolerate it really well.
What's the mechanism of action of the IUDs?
The Skyla and the Mirena IUD both have a tiny amount of hormone in it, just progesterone, not estrogen. Most of the medication stays right in the lining of the uterus. And for the Skyla IUD, for both of them, it sort of thins the endometrial lining. It also may inhibit ovulation somewhat, but it's more sort of a thinning of the endometrial lining. For the Skyla, the amount of hormone is not enough to really have a suppressive effect on the menstrual cycle, but for the Mirena IUD, most women wind up with a very light monthly period or no period at all. The copper IUD is non-hormonal, and it works with a sort of sterile inflammatory environment. But as I mentioned earlier, sometimes this can also lead to heavier bleeding.
Mm-hmm. We have an email. You've done a great job of describing this, and I need to perhaps maybe just take a quick second before I take this email and give our phone number again. It's 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. This is a writer. I do not know whether male or female, but they, whoever the writer is, wants men to take more responsibility and ask the following question, which you may not know the answer to since you're not a urologist. But I was hoping you would ask your guest, the listener asked, to speak about long-term, completely reversible contraception for men.
For men.
I believe the FDA is currently testing something that's injectable into the vas deferens.
I know that there has been research looking into reversible contraception for men. I heard it was a oral formulation. If there's an injectable formulation being studied, I'm not aware of that. However, in terms of men stepping up and taking some responsibility for this, when a woman is done completing childbearing and is coming into the office to discuss a tubal ligation, I always remind them that a vasectomy is a safer, cheaper, and outpatient procedure compared to a tubal ligation, which is a abdominal surgery. And so I encourage them to ask their male partner to go under the knife instead of them for once.
Right. And speaking of the fear of men about vasectomies, having had one myself, I can tell you that the next day I was up and at them. It was not a big problem. Went home and was really not in very much discomfort. And while I'm on this, I think I just had a patient who's, and I'm a pediatrician, but whose father had had his vasectomy reversed, and they managed to have a child. So I'm not sure how often that happens, but that's possible when these situations that are said to be irreversible. Here's another question. It says, I'm a 40-year-old and would like to go back on birth control. I like the idea of the long-term methods and great results in my 30s with the Depo shot. I was told that the Depo shot is not recommended for women over 30. Is this still true? I originally went the Depo route because I had high blood pressure, I have painful periods, and I haven't had any pregnancies. Can I or could I go back on the Depo? Is the question.
So the issue with women with medical problems like high blood pressure, diabetes, the concern is really with the estrogen that's in the combined oral contraceptive pills, and estrogen slightly increases the risk of blood clots, and so does having medical problems. And if women are smokers over the age of 35, those women can smoking increases the risk of blood clots, so those women cannot have combined oral contraceptive pills. So birth control methods that are progesterone only are great for older women, smokers, or women with medical problems. The progesterone only methods include there is a progesterone only type of birth control pill that I do not recommend. It's called the mini pill, and it's even less effective than the combined traditional birth control pills, and it's more finicky in that you have to take it at exactly the same time every day. So for an older woman with medical problems who really doesn't want to get pregnant, I don't recommend being on one of the least effective methods, but that does exist. Then there are Depo-Provera shots, which, like I mentioned before, are injections where you have to come back to the clinic for a shot every 3 months. Those are fine for women who are older to take, but if Depo-Provera is taken over a very long period of time, there may be some concern with bone loss. And what I would recommend for a woman in the collar situation would be a Mirena IUD. A Mirena IUD is also a progesterone-only device. It has also been recently FDA approved for not only contraception, but also the treatment of heavy bleeding. And so a lot of women with heavy, painful periods can really benefit for an IUD. Now, before going down that route, it's really important to have a thorough workup. I mean, if a woman is having heavy, painful periods, the question is why? So I always get an ultrasound to make sure they don't have something structural in their uterus, like fibroids or polyps, because in those situations, sometimes just removing the polyp will be more effective than, you know, trying to treat it with medication. Fibroids can also be removed, and women with fibroids can still have IUDs, but it's just a little bit less likely to control the bleeding than in a woman who has a structurally normal uterus and is just having sort of heavy bleeding for no good reason. In those women, the Mirena IUD works really well.
All right. So what I'm hearing is it sounds like a good idea for this lady to go back to her obstetrician gynecologist and really have a detailed talk about her personal situation and what would be the best way to treat it.
Exactly.
All right. All right. We're over halfway through the program. This has been one of those very, very fast days. So I want to remind listeners once again, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our local number, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short break and continue our discussion with Dr. Brooke Winter on contraception, and we're going to get to some questions or issues at least related to minimally invasive surgery. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, Your Health Connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, Your Health Connection, originating from KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest is gynecologic surgeon, Dr. Brooke Winter. Dr. Winter grew up in Anchorage. She's written was the original first author, I should say, on a paper in the New England Journal on the effectiveness of the long-acting reversible birth control. And she's also a specialist in minimally invasive gynecological surgery at Washington University in St. Louis. So we're talking about contraception up to this point. Shortly, we'll move over a little bit into the minimally invasive surgery issue. If you have questions or comments, our local number, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Keaton, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hey, I just wanted to know, for male birth control, how come is vasectomy the only option, or are there any pills that are a pill, something easy to do?
Okay. Dr. Winter, could you hear Keaton?
Control, why is vasectomy the only option?
Why aren't there any pills? Nothing's been developed along that line. Is it a lack of effort, or is it something?
We're working on it.
Especially the women
you can
out
wear
there.
A condom.
Yeah. All right. So there has been, people have been looking for oral oral things for men to do, but at this point, there's just not anything that's been discovered that's workable. Is that the right answer?
Exactly.
All right.
Thanks.
All right, Keaton. Thanks for your call. Just a couple more questions before we get off the birth control or contraceptive. What's the most common contraceptive method felt to be used now currently in the United States?
Birth control pills are currently the most effective method of birth control used in the United States. which is unfortunate since they have a failure rate of about 10%. Mm-hmm. If more women were using the longer-acting methods, such as the subdermal implants or the intrauterine devices, there would be fewer unintended pregnancies and fewer abortions in this country.
Right. How about the relative costs and ease of putting these in? I'm getting back to the question that we initially had at the beginning of the program about why don't more women choose the long-acting reversible, and you've said that once they've heard the story and really have good education, they're more likely to choose this. But there
right.
still are barriers to getting at least IUDs placed.
Right.
And so let's talk about those briefly.
So in the Contraceptive Choice Project, all the birth control was provided free to these women. And so, one barrier was, making sure they had full access to information, but the other barrier that was broken down was the cost component. And the problem is that long-acting methods can have high upfront costs, typically around $1,000 or more. Now, fortunately, this is usually covered by insurance, but it's important to check with your healthcare provider and your insurance company just to make sure so you don't get stuck with a large bill. That is in contrast to birth control pills that typically only cost between $5 to $60 per month. But to get a fair comparison, you have to add up the cost of those birth control pills every single month over several years, and then it evens out a little bit more. Plus, you have to consider the increased risk that pills will fail and then the cost of an unplanned pregnancy. So that should all be factored in as well.
Right. And how about getting people trained to do these things, the implant and the IUD? What does it take? How much effort? How much time?
Well, I mean, most OBGYNs who went through training recently or even not recently are trained to put these in.
Okay.
So I guess as a pediatrician, I would say just, I think it would be hard to implement a training program in which pediatricians were trained to put them in. Actually, here at Washington University, we do have a free clinic for homeless girls, and pediatricians and OBGYNs both work there. And we do try to train the pediatricians to implant devices, but I think that's a pretty unusual program. And so I would just say, refer the young woman to a gynecologist, and we'll get her taken care of.
And finally, I just want to comment, and you don't have to make any comments unless you'd want to, is that the American Academy of Pediatrics last year has made the recommendation that the first-line contraceptive choice for adolescents who choose not to be abstinent in having sex is a long-acting reversible contraceptive. I think that probably has a lot to do coming on the heels of that evidence that you supplied with your study with other colleagues there at Washington University.
Yeah. I mean, back in the old days, long-acting devices were reserved for older women or women who had already had babies, and that's sort of a very difficult barrier to break down. But I think it's important to reinforce that that's old-fashioned thinking. And we're now recommending long-acting devices as first-line options to all women, including teenagers. I don't know how many times I say that every day in clinic when I'm talking about this to women. And it makes sense. I mean, remember the data from my study. The teenagers and adolescents were even, worse at taking birth control pills than the older women who were still pretty bad at it. And that makes sense to me because teenagers and adolescents may be taking birth control without their parents' knowledge, which I don't recommend, but they might be doing that. They may not have access to their own transportation, so it's hard for them to pick up their prescriptions from the pharmacy. And they often have irregular schedules, like getting up early during the week and then sleeping in really late on the weekends, which makes it hard to take your pill at the same time every day or to get into the habit of taking it at the same time every day. So that's why I think long-acting devices are so important in these teenagers and young women. They honestly need them more than everybody else does.
All right. Well, we do have another email and a phone call, but I want to we'll come back to these. I think we will have time, but I want to go ahead and move on to your area of particular interest, which is this minimally invasive surgery. Would you define that for us and then tell us why this is advantageous?
Yeah, so Minimally invasive surgery is kind of a broad term to describe surgery that was previously performed through large incisions that can now, in the hands of trained specialists, be safely performed through smaller incisions. And the benefits to patients include less pain, faster recovery, fewer complications, and a better cosmetic result. But unfortunately, not all doctors are trained in these newer techniques.
What's the history of this? How long have these procedures been being done? And I know they've kind of become state of the art, but what's the history? How long have they been being? It's been
gynecologists actually were the first surgeons to start doing laparoscopy, and everybody thought they were crazy. And eventually, the general surgeons caught on, and this was all back in the 70s, I believe. And the general surgeons caught on and sort of took off running with it. And now it's the standard of care. If you have your gallbladder out or your appendix out, it is almost always done laparoscopically. The gynecologists have been a little slower to sort of universally adopt. And that's sort of an interesting question of why that is. One thing is that a hysterectomy is a much more difficult surgery than taking out a tiny little appendix or a gallbladder. There's much bigger blood vessels that are involved, and sometimes the uterus is very large. So I think that's one reason. But another reason is that, you know, general surgeons are just surgeons. All they do is operate all day long. Mm-hmm. OBGYNs, you know, do a lot of different things. We deliver babies. We do a lot of primary care, and we operate. And there's a lot of different modes of surgery that we're trained in. We're trained in open abdominal surgery with large incisions. We're trained in vaginal surgery. We're trained in laparoscopic surgery and robotic surgery. So it's honestly very difficult to become proficient in all those different modalities. So I think that's another reason why gynecology has lagged behind general surgery a little bit in adopting sort of universal minimally invasive techniques.
Does the term minimally invasive surgery often include the use of robotic equipment, or is this an area of overlap more than a coordinated component of invasive surgery, not minimally invasive surgery?
Yeah, so, you know, when I tell people I'm a minimally invasive specialist, they say, oh, so you do robotic surgery.
Right.
Robotic surgery is only one form of minimally invasive surgery, and it's the form that's been very well publicized and marketed.
Sure.
Laparoscopic surgery is another form of minimally invasive surgery, which actually involves fewer and smaller incisions than robotic surgery. And then vaginal surgery and hysteroscopic surgery, which is a camera inside the uterus, are older techniques, but those are also minimally invasive as well.
What are the, I'm sure that a lot, I'm not an expert on what the gynecologists are doing in Anchorage, but I'm sure there's individuals doing minimally invasive surgery here. What are the common kinds of surgery that you think women should really be aware of and ask about if they're about to have a gynecologic procedure done?
Well, pretty much any gynecologic surgery that is not done for cancer can be done minimally invasively. So the most common procedures would be a hysterectomy, which is removal of the uterus, a myomectomy, which is removal of fibroids alone, an oophorectomy, which is removal of an ovary, or a cystectomy, or removal of an ovarian cyst. There's tubal ligation procedures that we do minimally invasively, and then we can also treat or remove endometriosis minimally invasively as well. And whether or not a woman is offered a minimally invasive procedure has less to do with what surgery they're having or the difficulty level of the surgery than it does to do with sort of the comfort level of the doctor that they're seeing.
Mm-hmm. One of the procedures that I had somehow put down as a question about is uterine prolapse and the availability of minimal invasive surgery. I'm not sure why I put that down. Would you describe what that is, the reason it occurs, and whether or not minimally invasive surgery is recommended? Because I'm going to say recommended since there are other potential treatments being used.
Mm-hmm. So uterine or bladder prolapse means that these organs are sort of dropping down lower in the vagina than they should be. And this is common in older women, and it can be the result of the stress of childbirth, which can lead to a weakening of the muscles in the connective tissue that's kind of supposed to be holding everything up in place. This condition is not dangerous, and it doesn't need to be treated unless it's bothering the woman. Symptoms usually include sort of the sensation of pressure or a bulge, or if it's severe enough, sometimes women can actually see organs hanging out of their vagina. So pelvic floor muscle strengthening can help the symptoms. Those are kind of like Kegel exercises that can be taught with a directed sort of pelvic floor physical therapist. But exercises alone are not going to be enough to kind of lift the organs back up into place. The next step would be a rubber ring called a pessary that can be inserted into the vagina like a plug to hold things up. And then finally, surgery can be performed to kind of lift and tie things back into place. The surgery can be done minimally invasively either through a vaginal approach or a laparoscopic approach or a robotic approach. And of course, some people still do this abdominally with a large incision. And the laparoscopic or robotic approach is the most effective and holds up the best over time with the lowest failure rate.
Mm-hmm. I want to kind of comment on this point because I'm on the credentials committee at one of the hospitals here, and I am not a surgeon, but an issue that often comes up is looking at the amount of time it takes to do robotic surgeries. Do robotic surgeries in general take longer than a standard surgery, or should they not generally?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in the field of gynecology, there's really been no proven advantage of using the robot over conventional laparoscopy. Mm-hmm. There was actually a landmark paper published in 2013 in JAMA, which is our other very prestigious journal, and they basically showed in a very large national database type study that robotic hysterectomies took longer and cost more than laparoscopic hysterectomies with similar outcomes. And then they did a follow-up paper looking at the use of the robot for smaller procedures like removing ovaries, and they actually found there was an increase in complications. So it's important to remember that this is comparing robotic surgery to laparoscopic surgery. When you compare either robotic or laparoscopic surgery to open surgery, you know, either minimally invasive approach is much better than a big open surgery, but when comparing robotic to laparoscopic, the robotic surgery seems to take longer, and that may have to do with sort of the inherent nature of setting up the equipment and docking the robotic arms, and then the surgeon actually unscrubs and leaves the patient's body and goes and sits in a console on the other side of the room, and that whole process can take a while. But I suspect the other component of that is that the robot has been aggressively marketed to gynecologists as a way of making minimally invasive surgery easier, but unfortunately, the robot doesn't really tell you where to cut or what to do or how to do the surgery. And so there are some robotic surgeons out there who are fantastic surgeons who have great results, and, you know, I would send my mother to if she needed to be operated on. But there are other robotic surgeons who I'm afraid are using the robot as a crutch. Mm-hmm. And it's been marketed to gynecologists as a tool to help them. Mm-hmm. And I think if you need help in the operating room, you should get more training and not turn to a device.
Okay, thanks very much. All right, we've got one call and three emails. We've got about 10 minutes left. It looks like these are primarily on contraceptive issues. Do you have any other comments before we go back to some questions on contraception?
No, I think that'd be great.
All right, thanks very much for doing this again. Mary, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yeah, I have a 16-year-old daughter, and she just turned 16, and she's smart, she's going to go to college, she's amazing, but she's got her first boyfriend, and I suspect that she may be getting ready, if not already, be doing some things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and,
mm-hmm.
You know, I want these things for her. I want her to go to college. I don't mm-hmm. want her to end up pregnant. But mm-hmm. the minute I start talking to her about going on birth control, she completely flips out, insists that she's never done anything. But my thought is, if she is getting ready, then after she does it, it's already too late. And I want to mm-hmm. be proactive. So what do you do if you've got...
She won't talk to you?
She won't talk to me. She mm-hmm. uses, you know, and ironically, she mm-hmm. does not want to go talk to our pediatrician because mm-hmm. that person has known her forever and freaked out about the idea. But, you know, what
I would say, well, first of all, if she's so strongly denying it, is she afraid that she's going to get in trouble? So maybe if you kind of started the conversation with something like, you know, I think you're too young.
So.
I'd prefer you not. But if you are, I'd rather you be on birth control. I'm sure you've already tried that.
Yes, already tried that.
and then the next step I would say is, you know, see if you can get her to go to the gynecologist. And if you can, then just let the doctor talk to her by herself.
Okay.
And I think that would be the best thing. Find a gynecologist who you feel like she's going to connect with. Not to be sexist, but sometimes that's a younger female doctor.
Right. Yeah, and there are plenty
sorry
here in
to Anchorage. All of the great, right. great doctors that helped train me who are male, but that's what I would say. Take her to a gynecologist who you feel like she's going to like, and then leave the room. That's what I would do.
Is it okay to suggest, because if she's going to go on birth control, I know her well enough is to know that she probably would forget a pill, and if I... You know, I mean, it's a
I've had some
thing.
Mothers call the office and say, I'm bringing my teenage daughter, and I want to make sure you talk to her about birth control, which is great because I would have done that already, but I'm always a little bit scared that the parent is going to be mad at me for talking to their kid about that because I always kick the mom out of the room. And so if I get a little heads-up phone call like, hey, this is why I'm bringing her in, then that just clears it all up front and is great.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And
you're welcome.
How about a discussion about emergency birth control? Would that be worthwhile, Brooke?
Sure. So emergency contraception, you know, is sort of a last-ditch. It's not to be relied on. It's a last-ditch effort. And it is birth control that's used after you've already had unprotected sex. And you got to get it figured out within 5 days. So there's two different kinds. There's Plan B, which are pills that you take. And then you can also have a copper IUD, intrauterine device, inserted. And, again, either of these things sort of have to be taken care of within 5 days. But if you can, you know, the sooner the better after the unprotected sex, the more effective it is.
Question, my girl has night sweat. A man is sending a question. It says his girlfriend has night sweats. Could this be due to an implant that she's using for birth control?
Not likely. You should take her to the doctor.
Okay. Something else is going on, it sounds like there.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Another question. This comes from a lady who is in her mid-40s. She has stage 3 breast cancer that is estrogen receptor positive, I suspect she's saying.
Mm-hmm.
What is the best contraceptive in that situation for her?
Well, that's tricky because women who have a personal history of breast cancer are not good candidates for hormonal methods. How old is she? 40?
40.
So, you know, if a woman has completed childbearing, then she could consider a permanent sterilization with either a tubal occlusion or a tubal ligation. Or if she wants a reversible method, she could use the copper IUD, which is a non-hormonal IUD that's, you know, very effective and good for 10 years.
Okay. Another question that comes in is, what about girls young adults or women that have missed a pill, they're taking oral contraceptives and missed a pill. What's the advice?
So if you miss one pill, you should take it when you remember it. So if that means taking two the next day, great. If you miss more than that, you don't want it to end up taking like 3 or 4 pills all at a time because it'll make you very sick to your stomach. If you just miss one pill in a cycle, you should be protected for that cycle. But if you miss more than one pill, then you're going to have to use backup birth control for the rest of the cycle. And if you find that you're missing pills on a fairly regular basis, you should really look into getting on a birth control method that's not so hard to take.
We've got about 4 minutes or so, and I want to come back just briefly. There's still a lot of misconception, I feel, about the safety of oral birth control pills by themselves. I hear you in saying that the vast majority of women may be better on a long acting, but what about women who still have concerns about oral contraceptive tablets and long-term health benefits? Could you go over those just briefly again, what we really know right now?
Yeah, so oral contraceptive pills are safe in the vast majority of women. You know, I mentioned older women over the age of 35 who are smokers shouldn't take them. Women who have a lot of other medical problems like uncontrolled blood pressure or diabetes, they might want to stay away from them. But in the vast majority of sort of reproductive age women, birth control pills are safe. And they also have it's important. Well, the first thing it's important to remember, it's not birth control pills or nothing. It's birth control pills or pregnancy,
right,
and
right.
pregnancy or some sort of birth control versus pregnancy. And pregnancy is, carries its own set of health risks as well. So that's sort of an important thing to keep in mind. Birth control pills can also have other health benefits in addition to contraception. Some types of birth control pills can help clear up acne, and by inhibiting ovulation every month over the long term, birth control pills actually reduce the risk of ovarian cancer down the road.
Mm-hmm.
Every patient has an individual story, and you need to make sure that you talk to your doctor and they take a detailed health history and physical exam. But for the vast majority of women, birth control pills are safe.
And I appreciate what you said, and I so often I've made a comment on this program when we talk about safety, so many people worry about the safety of the treatment, the medication, the surgery, but it's mm-hmm. got to be weighed against the risk of not treating, and that's really mm-hmm. the decision. You need both sides of that equation to really make mm-hmm. the best answer. So thanks for bringing that up.
Mm-hmm.
Another maybe peripheral issue that's happened to me a couple of times, I have a couple of girls who have very significant medical problems that are wheelchair bound, and they really would like to stop their periods. It makes their life much easier. Kids with Down mm-hmm. syndrome is another group.
Mm-hmm.
What are the options there? What are your comments?
Sometimes Depo-Provera shots work really well to shut down their periods, and so that's an option. A Mirena IUD, if they could deal with having it inserted, is also an option. If they may be taking, multiple medications every day. So if they don't have any medical contraindications to birth control pills can be taken continuously, like I mentioned earlier in the program, which is skipping the last week, which are just sugar pills, and moving straight to the next pack. So all of those options would be there.
All right. Well, I really want to say thanks for taking the time. It's been a pleasure to talk with you again, and I want to wish you the best of luck. It's been a very educational program for me, and I really appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
All right. You have a good afternoon or good evening there in St. Louis.
Thanks. You too.
All right. So my thanks to today's guest, Dr. Brooke Winter. If you'd like to continue the conversation on contraception and gynecologic surgery, you can join KSKA on Facebook, and you can find the link on our website at alaskapublic.org. You can always go to the Line 1 archives at alaskapublic.org and listen to the program again, or you could refer somebody to listen to the program at any time. Next week, Line 1 is, of course, going to return. And next week, Prentice Pimpernan is going to host a return of the staff of the Covenant House for part two of his series on Alaska's homeless teens. Sex trafficking, drug addiction, street violence, sexual assault are all real dangers to teens that are on the street. So why don't you join him to discuss the options of helping this vulnerable population? Also, why not tune into Your Health and learn more next Monday, March 2nd at 2 p.m., repeating the same evening at 9 p.m. on FM 91.1 KSKA.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.